Welcome to the 21st. I'm Mary Hansen. Coming up later this hour, thousands of human organs are sent to recipients in need every year via commercial flights. But some arrive too late or don't arrive at all. But first, throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, Springfield boasted a bustling Pillsbury Mills plant, a factory on the north end of town that made flour and cake mixes, making the whole neighborhood smell sweet. At its peak, the plant provided good-paying jobs to 1,500 people, and the neighborhood thrived. But the decline in manufacturing that hit so many American cities affected Springfield, too. And by 2001, the plant had closed. Since then, neighbors say the site has become an eyesore and an environmental hazard. Springfield's former fire marshal, Chris Richmond, knows that factory well. His dad used to work there. He's leading a group that hopes to redevelop the former Pillsbury Mills site. Chris Richmond, welcome to the 21st.
I'm glad to be here.
And so, Chris, why do you want to redevelop the site instead of just tearing it down?
Right. Redeveloping the site's important because the old factory's been there so long and in such poor condition that the folks we talk to in the neighborhood are really ready to move on and beyond the old factory. They want to see it just gone from our community, and they want to see something else come into its place that's productive once again for their area of town and for the entire community.
So that sounds like a really positive vision. What are some of the political or economic challenges that you faced?
Right. The primary challenge, you know, the first question you always get asked in these sort of projects is financing. How do you finance something like this? Really, it starts with vision, though, on what do you want to do with that acreage once it's cleared? What's the best fit for the community, and what's the best outcome for the community in general? And then you design a development plan that you can then back numbers into to figure out how you're going to finance and pay for that as a community and what the community benefit is.
And so one of the recommendations from your group has been that the city of Springfield take ownership of the property. It's privately owned right now, which the mayor and some of the aldermen have said they're not in favor of. Why, in your view, is it necessary for redevelopment for the city to take it over? What happens if they refuse?
Right. As is often the case in these brownfield redevelopment projects, they need to be publicly owned on the front end so that they can coordinate state and federal level grant funding and then move toward a public-private partnership for redevelopment. In this case, that's almost assuredly necessary to happen. It's the site's already set for 15 years completely abandoned, and it's likely to sit for another several years. There's absolutely no private interest in the site because of the upfront cost to clear the contaminated site with the way it stands now.
And so what are the risks if the building keeps standing or if the site continues to sit there, as you mentioned that it might?
Right. And that's just it. When I worked for the city, I managed our public safety aspect of this property. And it's a large, dangerous, old factory property that's easily accessed by squatters and children in the neighborhood, curiosity seekers from all throughout the community. And we're just very lucky in our community that we haven't had some dramatic incident where somebody's been hurt or killed at the site. So really, you want to get your arms around this site before something like that happens.
And so Pillsbury isn't the only industrial site that's being considered for rehabilitation. There are other examples for your group to look to, including the Amarok building in Rockford. That's a former manufacturing plant that stood vacant near Rockford's downtown since 2000, so around the same time Pillsbury closed. And Joe Zirkle led the study to redevelop the Amarok building into a hotel and convention center. He's a principal of the engineering and environmental firm Fair Graham. Joel, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
And so how did the idea for redeveloping the Amarok building come to be?
There have been a number of private redevelopment proposals that had come and failed. And finally, the city actually stepped in and took ownership of the property and was able to leverage some US EPA brownfield grant dollars that they had had a lot of. They've had a lot of success and continue to have success in getting those grant dollars and putting them to effective use, because the private sector just simply wasn't going to step in and take on the environmental challenges of the property. There's just too many unknowns. And brownfields redevelopment really, at the end of the day, is still a real estate transaction. And a lot of times the goal is to remove that environmental twist that's in that real estate transaction. And so we were the city's environmental consultant doing their brownfields redevelopment work throughout the city, and we actually still doing that today. And that's where they were able to get far enough into the process of really understanding what the environmental condition is of the property that it finally did attract interest of the private developer.
And I definitely want to ask about the financial package, but first, what are some of the practical considerations or challenges for redeveloping a building like this into a different use, especially one that's so old and has been, you know, abandoned for so long?
Right. So, you know, there's always concerns about asbestos that can be in the buildings, pipe wrap, window glazing, floor tile, mastics. So that was an issue. Lead-based paint, when you're doing adaptive reuse, that can be an issue that where it needs to be removed. And so we had done some testing to prove that, you know, there was indeed lead-based paint in there. And so that was able to be quantified so that it could be built into the financial stack of, okay, we're going to have to do some lead-based paint abatement and get that out of there, especially with it going to be a hotel in the future. The other issue was the unknowns of the condition of the ground that the building and some of the adjacent lots sat on. And the city had already done some work, and so there was a pretty good understanding of that, but there were some things that we needed to do to address those environmental issues that we actually incorporated into the design of the building as well as the adjacent properties to make sure that we address those issues and satisfied not only the Illinois EPA, but also the state and federal historic tax credit investors that the developer brought to the table. And so they have their own requirements of what they would like to see.
And so all of that adds to the costs, it sounds like. I mean, I think one of the estimates that I saw for the cost to redevelop the hotel and convention center would be around $90 million. Who's paying for this, or how is this project being paid for?
The lion's share of it did come through the developer and their financial stack. Then there was state and federal historic tax credits. Then there were also some TIF dollars that were included, some private investment on the part of the developer, as well as some conventional financing. You know, all those different pieces of the financial stack that all had to kind of come together at the right time. And at any point, any of it could have not happened. But when you have a vision and passion, then that's usually when the stars will indeed align and you get everything put into place and the project can go forward. And our design team actually just had a tour of the building yesterday.
So great progress there, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Really moving forward. And as I know Chris mentioned vision. Chris and the Pillsbury Group, they'll likely encounter some similar challenges. What's your advice to them?
I think the big thing is that upfront of, and Chris and I have talked extensively about that, you know, you need information. You need data. You got to know. You can't just go off of hearsay. We really need to know what exactly are we dealing with the buildings themselves, lead-based paint, asbestos, and other potential contaminants. We need to understand, you know, kind of what is the condition of the ground. Maybe it's bad, maybe it's not. We really don't know. We're operating in a situation where we don't have a lot of that information. And once we get that, then a lot of times these sites, in my experience, lore is worse than actual fact. And once we start actually getting some of the information in, sometimes it's not near as bad as everybody thinks it is. It's a lot of perception. But once we start getting actual hard facts, we can really start to address those concerns.
Yeah, so getting the facts on the ground. So that was Joel Zirkel, who studied the prospect of redeveloping the vacant Amarok building in Rockford. And we're going to look at this from a more national perspective now. Joining us on the line from Pittsburgh is Don Carter, co-author of ReUSA, 20 American Stories of Adaptive Reuse. He's a senior research fellow at Carnegie Mellon University's Remaking Cities Institute. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Mary. And I enjoyed hearing from Joel and Chris about the projects in your region. Obviously, here in Pittsburgh, we're an industrial place that's trying to reinvent itself. And we've got examples of steel mills that have been torn down and replaced with mixed-use development. We've got examples of buildings being reused, like the Armstrong Cork Factory is now a high-end rental property. We have lots of loft conversions. And as we've discussed already, these are complicated projects. But they're important to the communities. It's really the legacy of that community, the history, the culture, the buildings themselves, the people who lived and worked and participated in the industrialization of a lot of these cities need to be recognized. And as you've heard on the financing side, it's very complicated. Almost always it's some kind of public-private partnership where you have a private developer, public input, sometimes philanthropic input, financial mechanisms such as historic tax credits and TIF financing. But it's happening all over the country. In Buffalo, they have what's called Silo City, old grain elevators. Same thing in Akron, Ohio with Croker Square. And in Pillsbury, in one project I did when I was in private practice, it's called the Mills District in Minneapolis, right on the river. And they've converted some of the grain elevators to other uses. They've built hotels, and they have a museum.
So a lot of good reuse projects there to look at. I'm actually from southwestern Pennsylvania, so I'm familiar with a couple of those Pittsburgh projects you mentioned. Definitely excited to hear about that. But I'm curious on the other side of this. What effect do these vacant buildings have when they're not being redeveloped on the surrounding communities? I'm curious in particular about working class communities that live near these former industrial sites, you know, where they might have used to work and you know, provided for their families. What effect do the vacant buildings have?
Well, on one hand, there's the physical, you know, it's blight. It's a building that's unoccupied. There's safety problems, as Fire Marshal was talking about. But there's also the psychological damage of seeing the thing every day and knowing your grandfather, your grandmother, or your father or mother worked in that place and now it's empty. You're mourning the loss of jobs. There seems to be some underlying false hope. One day it's going to open up again. The mill will open again or the factory will. Meanwhile, there's vandalism. There's people occupying the buildings. There's danger to children. So it draws negative vibrations all across the whole way, both financial, psychologically, and physically. And the reason I was mentioning the ones I mentioned is that every one that's been successful has had as its basis, as part of this vision that both of you have talked about, that they're going to celebrate the history that was there rather than run away from it. In Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, they still have some old rusting blast furnaces that they've turned into something called steel stacks. They have a casino there. They have a performing arts center, outdoor recreation places. But in all the cases I've already mentioned, the main thing is to celebrate what was there before and not to lose that as part of our heritage. In Minneapolis, in fact, there's something called the Mill Ruins Park. And there's also something called the Mills District Museum, Mill City Museum, which they talk about what was going on when they, whether it was General Mills or Pillsbury, what was happening there? What were the people's lives like?
So sort of a tribute to them while they're reusing it and while they're finding a new use for those spaces.
But they're not easy projects, as we've heard. There are environmental problems, financial problems. There are tons and tons of skeptics that say that'll never happen. It does take people with not only a vision, but commitment to to making it happen. And then once it's happened, like many things, it has lots and lots of supporters who said, well, we were along for the ride all the way. We thought that was a great idea.
Now we appreciate it. Well, let's hope that that happens in Springfield, too. Don, thank you so much for joining us. That was Don Carter. He's a senior research fellow at Carnegie Mellon University's Remaking Cities Institute. We were also joined by Joel Zirkel, a principal at the engineering and environmental firm Fair Graham, and Chris Richman, who leads the group Moving Pillsbury Forward.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk about why some organ donations never reach the people who need them most. I'm Mary Hansen. You're listening to The 21st.